There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
So David is our castaway. David, this is, you're going to be on this island. There's not going to be a library or a bookshop or anything like that. Internet, no. So can you tell us what your first book that you're going to grab and take with you to this desert island?
I would bring What If by the American military academic Robert Cowley. And what Robert has done is to bring together 20 other academic military historians and looked at various events through history from Persians right up to Second World War. And what they do is they look at key events which, if they had gone ever so slightly differently, would have completely changed history. And I'm going to look very quickly at three of those just by way of example. And the first one is the Battle of Teutoburg Forest, which at this point in AD 9, Augustus is on the throne in Rome, and Rome is pretty much at its peak at this point. And it's for the first time going to cross the Rhine and go north. And it sends a man called Varus. Now, Varus is a well-married man rather than the person who needs to do the job. Off he goes, and he works with a barbarian on the other side called Arminimus, who is known today in Germany as Hermann, Hermann the German, who consequently defeats three of the best legions in the Roman army. And what happens at that point is Rome decides that they're going to stay south of the Rhine. So the Roman Empire hits its peak at that point and never moves on. Arminimus then tries to declare himself king and is duly murdered by his cohorts. And what we have budding at this point in those German forests is the beginning of Western liberal democracy, where peoples decide that they are not going to have a Rome-style rule, where it is more about the importance of the self. And some historians have looked at that event and say that the Enlightenment, which comes after the Dark Ages, really can find its roots in that point as the Saxon hegemony across Northern Europe takes place. You have the Renaissance, which we wouldn't have had if we had the victory of the Roman Empire, which would have brought about a more internationalist global environment. The second one I'm going to move on to is the American Revolution. What's interesting about the American Revolution is that it actually happened at all. There's 13 key occasions where it could have completely failed. And one of the more interesting ones is a British officer by the name of Captain Ferguson comes across Washington, unarmed, on his own, in Brandywine Creek, and has his gun and has a clear shot at Washington, who's unarmed. Washington turns his horse to ride off, and Captain Ferguson could have shot him dead there and then, and he didn't, because that's not what a chap did. And if Washington had died, that particular incident of 13, that is the end of the American Revolution. And you have an interesting, they start talking about, well, what happens to the world in the future if the American Revolution fails? Does America, which, and let's put this in perspective, Australia and America are similar sized. Would America have just become independent as a dominion, like Canada? Or in fact, Canada and America would have been one and the same, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. Would the British then have not focused on the East, even though the East India Company was operating in India? The British government wasn't looking at that as a colonial outpost. So the world changes. And finally, I look at China and Taiwan, and we look at post-World War II. The settlement has been done between the powerful leaders. Stalin has decided there's nothing for the communists in China. However, the leader of the nationalists, Kai-shek, decides to invade Manchuria. If he hadn't, what you would have had today, and it probably still would be the case, is China would have been split in two. You would have had the nationalists running the whole south of China. And what that means, if you look at how history falls out after Mao Zedong takes over China, is it's unlikely Vietnam would have ever happened, Korea would have ever happened. Instead, it would have all been concentrated in China itself. And as I say, you've got 20 of these stories, and you can read each one in their own right and consider what the future would have been. And of course, given now you're on an island, you have the time to consider other events and what might have happened. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. And Robert does a great job in editing it, so there is a standardization of how you read. Although there is, throughout the book, various short, maybe half a page or a page from the actual military historian who did that particular piece, where he gives additional thoughts. Wonderful read.
Brilliant. So really a dipping into book, not one to sort of pick up and read right the way through, but maybe people have got specific parts of history that they're interested in that would appeal to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we're in an age where people's attention spans are very poor.
Indeed.
The idea of dropping a 1,000-page book in front of somebody, I don't know if people can do that anymore. So it'd be much better if we are in that attention deficit disorder world to give something that people can actually digest and make them question. Mm. And once they've done enough of that, maybe then they're ready to move on to the books we grew up with, where you would sit and read a 1,000-page tome.
So how did you come across this particular book?
It was recommended by a great friend of mine, a South African, Lise Watley, who said I would enjoy it, and I have thoroughly. So when I got asked to come on the show, and thinking about being on a desert island, this was an absolute must.
And I think it's a kind of book that you could go back to again and again, and sort of you could read it in your first year as a castaway, then you could come back 2 years later, read it again as a castaway, because you might have had more experiences in that time. And you can, you know, the thing is, we know what happened, but it is what could have happened, which is so fascinating.
Yeah. And I would say to anybody who picks this book up and reads it, once you have that done and you've questioned it, I'd move on to Edward Gibbon's Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, which is late 18th century. And what's wonderful about his book is you read it in section and then you sit back and think, when has this happened recently? And what you learn after finishing the book is there's almost nothing new in the world at all. All that's happened is we've got better at doing things. Mm. It's a fascinating read.
And I think that's one of the arguments for history being such a great subject to study at school, mm-hmm. that actually you do see the context of, that's happened before. That's happening again.
Yeah.
So a good
but never slightly in the same way.
Absolutely.
Always variations on a theme.
Slightly different.
And the way that the world, world power and world focus moves, doesn't it, from country to country.
Yeah.
And everyone has their time, as it were.
Yes. And I was at a talk by a guy called Todd Burkhoff. He was a top American economist. And he made the point about, how nothing has a right to survive. And he was talking about the fact that in his grandmother's time there were Ottomans, there were Austro-Hungarians. If you ask a child today, they don't know what you're even talking about. But these were peoples who were around for 1,000 years who are now gone in a couple of generations. Totally out of mind.
Just remind us again of the title of the book and the author, if
you
wouldn't mind.
What If by Robert Cowley.
Brilliant. And that's the first of our Castaway books. We're on to our second book, which I have noticed a lot of people cheat slightly on this. So this isn't really one book, is it? Is it, David? Is it one book?
It was released as one book. Mm. It was released as four books. It's been released, I believe, as 12 books. It is The History of the English-Speaking Peoples by Winston Churchill.
And how many pages?
Oh, God, about 2,500.
Yeah.
And it is wonderful. And what's great about it, let's just think about Winston Churchill as a writer. Winston Churchill is generally considered to have had a vocabulary about four times that of the average person, which I believe is about 5,000 to 10,000 words. The other thing Churchill had the ability to do, even with all these words, was write simply, something I'm very jealous of. On a more interesting note with Churchill, not many people are aware of this, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature for his war diaries in 1953, but he's also the only Nobel Prize winner to ask people not to read his fiction, which he thought, having written and published it, was not very good. He's a very interesting man, a bit of a polymath in that regard. So he writes the history of the English-speaking people, and it's a bit of a roller coaster. There has been criticism of it because it's said by some to be a bit rose-tinted. I disagree with that. He pretty much sticks to the facts. And also, he's got to cover 2,000 years of history in 2,500 pages. So we kick off in book one, and we kick off with Roman Britain, We move quickly on to the formation of Britain as a nation, Alfred the Great at the end of the 8th century, before we have the end of the feudal age and the death of Richard III, who got buried recently. And what you find in reading just the first book alone is how universal those great events are, how a small little island nation, the events in there are so well known globally. Within that first book alone, we have the birth of common law, one of the two great traditions of law globally after the French system of codex. And we have the Magna Carta, which is probably the first detailed system of rights. Okay, it's very restricted, but it's a base document. And that is still applicable in British law today. We see the influx of Norman culture. We see the defeat of the Romans starting to retreat. We see the introduction of the Vikings, the rise of the Saxons, and then their defeat by the Normans. And finally, the end of feudalism. So much happening in a short period of time with great characters who are represented in popular culture globally. The Boadiceas, Alfred the Great, William the Conqueror, Richard the Lionheart, King John, all these wonderful characters which are so alive in any number of medium of education, entertainment, etc., who are known globally from this tiny island.
Robin Hood?
Robin Hood would be around the time of King John. So in terms of, if you were to set it historically,
he would have,
even though he's
covered
fictional.
That, yes. Yeah. He's not fictional.
Well, there's somebody called Robin of Locksley, but yes. In terms of, does it exist in the Maid Marian, Little John and so on?
Yes, perhaps not, but I do believe there is probably, possibly not enough evidence, but that he actually did exist in some way, shape or form.
Oh, I would agree with that, and we've romanticised it, and there's nothing wrong with that. Mm. Yeah, and as a child, I grew up with it.
Yes, exactly. And I think Boadicea, what I like is that in this book, I believe that Churchill does touch on female, characters who changed maybe the course of history, because she was a female leader. Mm-hmm. I think she was the Iceni, wasn't she? She was the sort of the queen of the Iceni, and she challenged the...
the orthodoxy of the day, absolutely.
Yes.
There's a wonderful moment in one of the later books where he talks about the burial of Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth, who are buried side by side in Westminster Abbey.
Sisters.
Yeah, and it's an interesting one because obviously their younger brother, Edward VI, gets to the throne first. He lasts all of 6 years. I think he was dead at 13. He is kind of neutral in terms of the Reformation in Britain. Mary comes along and we start torching the other side. Elizabeth comes along and we torch the other side. And we end up with this wonderful situation with all the damage and hurt that was done through the Reformation, with these two sisters on opposing sides buried together in Westminster Abbey. And I can't remember the Latin that's written on the tombstone, but it's something like the two sisters going to heaven, seeking heaven together. It's wonderful.
But
really
Elizabeth
is.
passed the death sentence, didn't she, on Mary? I mean, and she found that very hard to do, quite, understandably. But when she realised that Mary was never actually going to leave her in peace to rule, she had to have her put down.
And again, within that period, let's go back to global awareness. You've got the Six Wives of Henry VIII, you've got Queen Elizabeth, you've got Guy Fawkes, but you've got some minor events which are going to become important later on. You have the sailing of the Mayflower.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have got the end of the Spanish in terms of their naval power. They send a large fleet off to Britain, the Armada story we all are aware of.
And which was an incredible... it's events like that that I think may not have happened, but they did.
Yeah.
And they have changed the course of history. So we go back to almost the what if.
Yep.
That no one, the sort of people could not have foreseen that success.
No, absolutely. And the interesting thing is, if the fireships hadn't worked, the defences up the Thames were so weak, the Spanish would very quickly have overcome England.
Mm.
A very, very minor thing changes the course of history.
And Dunkirk recently, I don't know if you've seen the film.
One sunny day.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And again, Churchill, we're talking about Churchill, his amazing speech Which we will fight them on the beaches and mm-hmm. so on and so forth, which has become part of you know, British folklore and history, really, that it was not a foregone conclusion mm-hmm. that the Second World War would end as it did.
No, absolutely.
Indeed not.
In fact, if you go back to the What If book, there's a whole scenario on if Hitler hadn't gone to Russia and instead had gone down to the Middle East, he might have won.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant. It's a great piece of writing.
Yes. And Churchill, in I don't know which volume it is, but mentions Florence Nightingale, how her sort of influence actually started the whole women getting the vote, women, mm-hmm. you know, being more empowered. And it was sort of a pivotal moment that changed how people viewed women
The fourth book. And, of course, that's also the first time in the Crimean War you start to get the press embedded. So people are now starting to understand what's actually happening in war. It's not until the First World War that you start getting remembrances to the common soldier. There's always a lag. All those memorials we see in the villages and towns across Britain really, as you say, have their origins in the Crimean War and later off into the Boer War.
Mm. So how up to date is the book? When did he write it? Where did he stop?
He wrote it into the late 30s. I think it was finished by 1939, but then it gets edited during his lifetime. It ends with the Victorian era.
Okay.
The last one he deals with is the Boer War in the 1900s.
Okay, so, 100 years.
Yeah.
100 years ago, pretty much.
What else is in there that's interesting? One of the things which I do like about it is the history of the English-speaking people, so it's not all about Britain either. If you go into the third book, he spends a significant amount of time talking about America. And there's an element of torch passing. And if you look at the American War of Independence, which to an extent has got some of its origins in Freemasonry. Most of the founding fathers were, as was Lord Cornwallis, and there is a bit of a theory that there was a lot of sympathy amongst the British serving officers in America at the time for the Revolution. If that hadn't been there, again, would they have fought slightly different? Who knows? But you are starting to see the torch either being passed or shared, depending on how you look at that. And you're looking at the hegemony of going back to that forest in, 8 or 9 AD, where the rights of the individual trump the internationalist nature of the early Roman Empire.
Okay, so this is quite an epic read for your desert island.
Mm-hmm.
What made you choose this one? You were I don't know, I sort of haven't obviously followed the emails between you and Annabelle, but normally yeah. people are like, oh, I don't know. You seemed quite definite in the books you were choosing. So why this one in particular?
This one again in particular, if you just look at the index and you read through the chapter titles, they're all instantly identifiable events or identifiable people. And again, they're almost like little vignettes. You can sit and lose yourself in those 15 or 20 pages mm-hmm. and just sit back for a day or two or a week or two and mull it through.
So not a book to necessarily pick up at volume one and work your way through to volume four, the end, but certainly a dipping into book.
What a collection to have on your bookshelf at home. You know, I tend to love literary fiction. That's my sort of area where I will start. But I also love the two books, the What If book and this, because I'm so fascinated by history.
Mm-hmm.
And to have sort of someone like Winston Churchill's mind, his incredible mind, putting together what he, you know, because he's making selections, isn't he, all the time?
Yeah, no, very much so. I've got these in first edition. I still can't read off a computer. And I am an avid collector of first editions. So I do have this in first edition.
I think this set of books has to be a real book. I cannot imagine reading it. I do read on a Kindle, I read on my iPad. I cannot imagine reading something like this. This is something you have to own,
yeah.
I feel.
Very much so. You could happily sit on the beach and just lose the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so send yourself back.
Did you come across it first in that first edition, or did you come across it and then, I need the first edition?
No, I had read the war diaries, and having read those, I went looking for what else there was, came across the history of the English-speaking people, read a few reviews, and at that point I was collecting first editions. So, I just went online, I think it's ABC, there's a website, mm-hmm. and I picked it up there.
Excellent. And I think you are an astute, very astute person, David, because books now are turning into works of arts, and people are collecting rare editions of all sorts of books. Mm-hmm. I mean, going back, you know, 200-300 years at least, where they can, to get the first edition, the, you know, perfect.
The danger with them, of course, I think it's from either the 30s or early 40s, is the paper that's used.
Mm.
They are not going to last, sadly.
Yeah, but once before that.
Once before that. I think from the 20s back, you're in safe hands.
During the war, there was the issue with paper anyway, and I suspect it never quite recovered and went back to the same standard of paper.
Absolutely, there's a high acid content.
Yeah.
So, you see the tarnishing fairly quickly.
Very quickly, yeah.
Boo.
One of those things that happens. I have to apologise for an error I made in my ramblings about Diff, because I didn't actually mention the name of the film that I was talking about.
On
Chesil Beach. Yeah.
Yes.
So
one
just in case.
It was a novella.
Absolutely.
And it was shortlisted. It's a literary fiction. It was shortlisted or longlisted for the Booker. Of course, Ian McEwan is most famous probably for Enduring Love and Atonement.
Atonement, absolutely.
And apparently Atonement, in that article we were talking about earlier, is the best-selling. You've got Atonement, you've got Life of Pi, and there are a couple of others, literary fiction, that have really sold, you know, millions.
Exactly.
And I wonder if it's because they've also been a film and therefore become more accessible.
Yeah, more accessible, I would say. So apologies there. On Chesil Beach, next June. Read the book, go and see the movie.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
And the seagulls are leaving the building again. We are still on that desert island, however, with David Daly. And we've talked about Churchill, we've talked about Cowley, and now... not get further than C? Just a minute, hang on.
Actually,
you just looked at your bookshelves and you just got to C and stopped.
Yeah, pretty much. Who could blame me? There's so many good things.
So what's next?
What next is Agatha Christie, one of my favourite authors.
Hurrah,
yes. We have a fan in studio as well. And I've gone for what is, I think, her best-selling book. Sold about 100 million. You've got to remember, Christie has sold 2 billion books. She's the third largest selling author in history. And There Were None is such a wonderful book. You have 10 characters starting, and by the end, they are all dead. And by the end, you have got to the second and last chapter, and you still haven't got a clue who's done it.
It's true. Yeah.
It's wonderful writing. It really, really is. It captures the paranoia, and it all happens over a nice, manageable amount of time. And again, as I was saying earlier on, in 200 pages. She doesn't, through her career, feel the need to flesh out her books. And I'm just going to diverge slightly for, say, our younger viewers. Think of J.K. Rowling, her first three books. They're about 200 pages each.
Yeah.
And then she becomes famous. Bing! Next thing, they expand. Christie never did that, and she was world famous. She wrote these wonderful, tight books, and I think it's a shame we don't see as much of that anymore. There's an element of laziness, I think, that's got into writing, but that's just my opinion. So why do I pick this one in particular? Again, I suppose you're looking at 10 discrete little mysteries. The characters arrive on the island. They find a little poem, which starts, 10 little Indians went out to dine, one choked his little self, and then there were nine. You can imagine what happens to character number one. And so it continues. And it's fascinating how long it even takes people, with the speed that things are happening, to realise that it is right in front of them what is going on. And that was always one of the great things about Christie. She would wave the solution at you, and you would bat it out of the way. Get out of my way. I'm looking at something else. And she did this through, I think it was 66 crime full novels, and there was about 80-odd novels in total. There were a lot of collected stories. I enjoy being led astray in the same way. There was a show, I think, a couple of years ago, Magic's Greatest Tricks Revealed. I didn't watch it. I don't want to know. I want to be fooled. I want to be tricked. I want to get to the end and go... So, on this desert island, there has to be an Agatha Christie there, and there's little better one than this one.
I would agree. I would be hard-pushed to say what my favourite is. I am a Miss Marple fan. I would like to be Miss Marple. As I get older, I see myself growing into the role. I've taken up knitting again. I'm practising. Got some of the... going into sensible shoes, got the skirts, might take up gardening, pruning the roses. But Miss Marple, for me, is an excellent character. I love her and the books that she features in. But Agatha Christie is part of the whole golden age of crime. There are some amazing writers who haven't survived in the public's memory in the way that Agatha Christie has, for whatever reasons.
Naomi Marsh, Dorothy Sayers.
Yeah, I think Dorothy Sayers, definitely around the same time. I think she's quite different, actually, Dorothy L. Sayers. But there's certainly those Cyril Hare. There are a lot. Yeah, Patricia Wentworth.
They've gone.
I'm shaking my head.
Yeah. No, they've not gone in my mind. They've not gone on my Kindle or indeed on my bookshelf. So, yeah, Agatha Christie's part of that, but she has absolutely survived.
It must be to do with the quality of her writing and the characters. I mean, Miss Marple and Hercule Poirot are two of the most well-known and beloved of the detectives, which we've got so many now. But everyone loves the way that Miss Marple, particularly, I think, is someone that the sort of harmless spinster who lives in a village, and no one would ever expect her to be able to work out who'd done what.
There's a great Margaret Rutherford movie which starts with her on a jury. And the judge is summing up, and you hear a click clack, and she's sitting in the jury box knitting. And for me, she is the Miss Marple. I know Joan Hickson has probably done more.
I do quite like Joan Hickson. I must admit, in my head, she's there. But again, the TV adaptations and the films have helped to keep the Christie story going.
Oh, very much so. I mean, I got lucky. I suppose I grew up in a small country in the west, or a small village in the west of Ireland, and I was a big fan of the Basil Rathbone Sherlock Holmes. Mm-hmm. And reading these books, this was the reading version of that visual, both in terms of my living environment and some of the early TV that I had watched. You could just lose yourself in these wonderful characters. And, of course, it was plot-driven.
Yes, completely.
I think a lot of the crime novels today, the case Carpetta stories, for example, they've lost that. That part of it is almost secondary.
Yes, it's all about the character.
Yeah,
and with Christie, it's not so much. I mean, for me, they're my comfort read. When my brain is fried and frazzled, if I wake at 2 a.m. and I can't sleep, that's what I'll read. For me, it's like having a mug of Horlicks and a block of chocolate.
Yeah.
And I just need the Christie to go with it. Mm-hmm. Did you see the TV adaptation of your particular book?
I did indeed, the Charles Dance version.
Yeah.
Wonderful. They kept true to the original.
They did.
Thank
I absolutely
goodness.
Loved that.
Because Christie changed the stage version, which I've seen here. Backstage did it a few years ago. And they followed the stage version, which is just not as good.
Mm.
It really isn't. There's no real shock at the end.
No.
You find
no.
out who does it, but meh, who cares?
But the
book is better.
I agree that the TV one, you know, if you want an adaptation, it is a very, 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 very good one.
And, of course, the BBC, I think, are doing Crooked House this Christmas.
Oh, are they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That will be gosh.
And so I'm very much looking forward to that.
And then There Were None by Agatha Christie, your third book that you're going to be taking away with you to your desert island. It's not Miss Marple and it's not Hercule Poirot. It's just 10 characters, isn't it?
It is just 10 characters. And apparently this is one of the ones she had to take quite a bit of time with. And that's quite understandable. And you're talking about a lady who was knocking out 2 books a year off this type of quality. I'll have to bring this one with me. I could bring the ABC Murders. I'm a big fan of that. If I was to move away from the classics like Murder of Roger Arkoy, Death in the Nile, etc. But this is just such a wonderfully written mystery.
Yeah, I'm going to go away and reread it because I haven't read this one for a long, long time.
And apparently it was voted in 2015, not so long ago, as the world's most favourite Agatha Christie mystery. So you're in good company there.
Yeah.
If anyone else turns up on your desert island, I'm sure they're going to love it.
any listeners, would if you'd like to message into 4001, tell us what your favourite Agatha Christie is. We'd like to know that, actually.
If I've got a moment or two, which is interesting with Christie, because she left the last Hercule Poirot book and Miss Marple book, which she had written in the 40s, and they weren't released until after her death in 76. Although in the later years, I think her later books, Postern of Faith at Bertram's, was it Bertram's mm-hmm. Hotel?
That's Passenger right.
to Frankfurt.
Yeah.
She is starting to slip slightly. I mean, the woman was in her 80s. But by having two books written in her prime, that really held together her reputation. Because that was seen as new, even though it wasn't. So it was quite clever. So for authors out there today, in your 40s, write two good books, put them away to be released after you die. And you will be considered a more even writer across your lifetime.
It's true, actually. It's good marketing. That's a good top tip there for aspiring writers to make sure you do that. So, yeah, absolute pleasure today to be able to talk about Agatha Christie. But for once on the radio, without being mocked for my passion for crime stories,
I love Agatha Christie. I mean, for me, it was being able to read the whole lot one after the other, and mm-hmm. sort of get completely caught up in, you know, as you said, it's plot driven, but it is such a satisfying read, mm-hmm. and I think also you can give it to sort of anyone. It's never going to be offensive, so yep. teenagers could read it and there wouldn't be anything there that you'd be worried
yeah,
about.
And they were certainly some of the first adult books yes. that I read.
Yes,
yeah.
yes.
I mean, there was a bit of criticism, not much of it, that her books were quite off their period. And I think she was being more attacked for the pre-World War II, which would be kind of seen in a colonial light. But her books were very contemporary. I mean, you look at Third Girl. You've got a gang of girls sharing an apartment in central London.
Mm-hmm.
Passenger to Frankfurt looks at post-World War II, what happens post-Nazis, etc. She very much kept up with the times.
Mm.
And that's reflective of her as a person.
And she had a fascinating life.
Amazing life. Really is a wonderful
woman. I mean, yes, there's so many there's mystery around her disappearance and mm-hmm. all sorts of other things. So I think, thank goodness for Agatha Christie.
Yep.
And what a brilliant choice of books you have chosen. Two non-fiction
mm-hmm.
That were focused on history. And then, of course, the queen of crime today as much as she ever was. And incredibly popular in translation. I know in Arabic, Agatha Christie is probably the most popular author in translation.
Mm.
Okay.
So she's certainly enduring, and I think, as you quite rightly said, Yvette, she stood the test of time, whereas
Definitely,
the others
yeah.
you know,
strange.
Haven't.
Patricia Wentworth, who I mentioned, has written a series with the central character is Maud Silver, who is very Marple-esque. Now, I haven't actually dug into the details and checked this, but apparently Maud existed before Jane Marple, but they
okay.
are very, very similar characters, so quite interesting, actually. And her books are still available in paperback and certainly via Kindle.
Well, I've just taken a note of the name. Oh, one other thing, of course, is the Christie family have signed off to her grandson, a British writer. Is it Sophie Hannah?
Yes, Sophie Hannah, who's been at the festival and yep. was also doing a creative writing workshop earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have got the new book, The Monogram Murders, and I think the second one's either out or coming, which I have yet to read.
Yeah.
She must do
good.
Over Christmas.
I think she does a really, really mm-hmm. good job. I mean, she talked when she was here about how she got permission from the Christie estate to mm-hmm. do this and how it was actually sort of fairly casual almost, mm-hmm. but they liked to work, they liked what she did. So I enjoyed them, yeah, very,
okay.
very much.
Good, yeah. I will have
yeah.
a read.
So add those to your... your Christmas list.
Thank
I
you
think.
So much, David, for being our castaway today and entertaining us with the wonderful choices of books. I think Yvette and I certainly will be taking a kayak or a catamaran to visit your desert island and
you
read
much.
Your books on your little bookshelf.
We may even bring you back to, to the
kind.
Wider world, if that's okay.
Yes.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.